Hi, David Mee here. This is For the Record program number 1345, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 19. This is being recorded on September 1st of the year 2024. And once again, it is my pleasure and my privilege to introduce or reintroduce to the audience my new co-host, Monty. And we're going to be moving to Asia, of all things. And that may seem like a real reach, but actually it follows very directly on the things we have been talking about. And as I have mentioned several times, for a younger person who would like to understand the world that he or she is living in, understanding two events, the assassination of JFK and World War II, and the two are inextricably linked. And that is a really important understanding to have. And in that regard, I'm going to begin by reading an excerpt from the book The Man Who Knew Too Much by Dick Russell. The hardcover edition was published by Carroll and Graff in 1992. And we're going to read the text of Jack Ruby's last letter out of prison, which was January 31st, 1966. He had already been injected with cancer. And Ruby in that letter said, quote, "Don't believe the Warren report. That was only put out to make me look innocent. I'm going to die a horrible death anyway, so what would I have to gain by writing all this? So you must believe me. That is only one kind, or there is only one kind of people that would do such a thing. That would have to be the Nazis. And that is who is in power in this country right now. Japan is also in on the deal. Then the old warlords are going to come back. South America is also full of these Nazis. If those people were so determined to frame me, then you must be convinced that they have an ulterior motive for doing the same. There is only one kind of people that would go to such extremes, and that would be the master race." And obviously he's also talking about Japan. And I'm also going to read an excerpt from the book JFK, The CIA, Vietnam, and the Plot to Assassinate John F. Kennedy by retired Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty, published in hardcover by Skyhorse Publishing. And Colonel Prouty was in Okinawa when the atomic bombs were dropped on Japan, and he was strolling around the harbor and taking note of the enormous stockpile of military equipment that had been assembled there for an invasion of Japan. And probably, I'm quoting here, "I was on Okinawa at that time, and during I was on Okinawa at that time and doing some business in the harbor area. I asked the harbor master if all that new material was now going to be returned to the States. His response was direct and surprising. Quote, hell no, they ain't never going to see it again. One half of this stuff, enough to equip and supply at least 150,000 men, is going to Korea. And the other half is going to Indochina." Unquote. In 1945, none of us had any idea that the first battles of the Cold War were going to be fought by U.S. military units in those two regions beginning in 1956 and 1965. Yet, that is precisely what had been planned, and it is precisely what happened. Who made that decision back in 1943 and 1945, or 1943 to 1945? And I'm also going to read an excerpt from the book, The Nightmare Decade, The Life and Times of Senator Joe McCarthy by Fred J. Cook. And by the way, McCarthy was cited as one of the heroic role models in the book we talked about called Unhumans in our last series.
Mr. Emery, if I may interrupt, sure. I'd like to circle back to Colonel Prouty after your excerpt from The Nightmare Decade, if I may.
Sure.
Wonderful.
I'm going to read this, and then I'm going to give the audience a tease.
Thank you.
many of the topics that we're going to be covering, and this is going to take a long time, but I want to whet their appetite because
What I want to do is put the Colonel Prouty quote about the war materials in its proper context and what Colonel Prouty actually had to do with that operation. But ultimately, please do share the excerpt from the Nightmare Decade, please.
okay. And this again, The Nightmare Decade by Fred Crook, published in hardcover by Random House. Copyright, I don't have the 1971 by Fred Crook. And he writes, "When the war ended, China was in utter chaos. Thousands of Japanese troops wandered around the countryside fully armed, with no one accepting their surrender." John F. Melby, M-E-L-B-Y, a State Department officer, in a day-to-day diary he kept at the time, reflected in bewilderment upon this anomaly. On December 27th, 1945, he noted, quote, "I still don't understand about the Japanese. Officially, they are being disarmed, but the fact is they never seem to be. In Shanghai, 15,000 still walk the streets with full equipment. In Nanking, the high Japanese generals are bosom buddies of the Chinese." Now, that, of course, would be the Kuomintang fascists of Chiang Kai-shek. Continuing. "In the north, tens of thousands of Japanese soldiers are used to guard railroads and warehouses and to fight the communists. If you ask what this is all about, the answer is either a denial or, in more candid moments, a 'shh, we don't talk about that,'" unquote. In another entry on January 30th, 1947, a good 16 months after VJ Day, Melby noted that though it was being kept very quiet, unquote, there were, again quoting, 80,000 holdout Japanese troops in eastern and northwestern Manchuria who are fully equipped fighting the communists, unquote. Now, this is something we just don't get told about, and as what in Boston would be called an old fart who grew up watching Victory at Sea. You know, this is absolutely stunning. And before we have you beginning to unpack your work, Monty, I'm going to do something, I think, but by way of trying to clarify things for the listeners. Something like an abstract for a scientific paper. Now, this series obviously is going to be going on for a while.
Right.
To give you an idea, to give the audience an idea of some of the topics we're going to be covering, and these are in effect bullet points. Standing right next to Jack Ruby at a press conference that he had. Now, was this on the evening of Saturday, November 23rd, in 63, Monty, I think? That press conference.
No, this was the evening of the 22nd, the press conference where Jack Ruby is photographed with a potentially interesting character in the narrative we're going to be developing.
Absolutely. This is a cabinet research officer standing next to Ruby at the press conference, and we'll have you tell us what that cabinet research bureau was.
The office is called the Cabinet Research Bureau. And just to give a quick encapsulation of what that was, for the listening audience, try to imagine the FBI, the CIA, and Army Intelligence all in one super organization reporting up to the Prime Minister of Japan and controlling all the security for the cabinet ministers. That is Cabinet Research Bureau, a super spy organization.
And so Ruby is standing right next to a major Japanese spook. Next point, General Seizu Arisu and his myriad connections. Do you want to try to synopsize Arisu, or should we just kind of, I could characterize him, and we'll be developing this
Well,
later.
there are three points I'd like to synopsize of Arisu. One, he's the commander of all G2 intelligence during the Second World War, for the Japanese. He is one of the supreme ministers for the Total War Plan, which is the occupation of all of Asia and the island nations of the Pacific for the Japanese Bushido fascists. And he is also at one point the military intelligence liaison to the Vatican for the Imperial Japanese War Cabinet. So that's Arisu. He is a, what can I say, a jack of all trades when it comes to controlling foreign policy for the Japanese during the Second World War and the supreme intelligence officer for the entire occupied territories of the Japanese military. Very important character.
Very important, and perhaps for our purposes, he might be characterized, I think, quite fairly as the Japanese Galen. He served an analogous role with the U.S. as General Reinhard Galen, a name very well known to the audience. Another part of the
Absolutely.
Tsuji Masanobu, first name capital Tsuji, last name. Whoops,
Yeah.
sorry. I've got my laptop here again. The logistics is very tough because we're in the recording studio. Tsuji Masanobu and his links to Arisu, the Bataan Death March, and also Iris Chang's alleged suicide. The 20th anniversary is coming up later this year. And
Once again, if I were to encapsulate, forgive me with the pronunciation of his last name. How's that pronounced again, Dave?
Tsuji Masanobu, I believe.
Masanobu.
Masanobu. Yep.
Yeah, my general, excuse me, during World War II, Colonel Masanobu, was essentially the commander of, to draw a comparison with, say, COINTELPRO. He was the chief of anti-communist intelligence for the Imperial Japanese Army, and he ran hunter-killer death squads all throughout occupied Malaysia.
And he also worked very closely with Arisu and worked drumroll fanfare with and for U.S. intelligence in the post-war period. And
As a point of fact, real quick, he was the one of the multiple deputies that General Arisu had when both men were full-fledged U.S. Central Intelligence Agency operatives.
Both Syngman Rhee, the dictator and strongman of South Korea, and Ngo Dzin-diem, who was the head of state in Vietnam, both had worked for the Japanese prior to and during World War II.
Absolutely. And later on in a future program, I'm going to demonstrate that the Kim Jong-il, who was the founder of the Korean CIA, or simply KCIA, as it was called inside of internal CIA memoranda, had created a religious relief organization called the Unitarian Church. And the Unitarian Church, for all intents and practical purposes, was the eyes and ears of Korean CIA
I
throughout the
think
1950s and 60s.
you mean Unification Church, not Unitarian.
Correct. Excuse me, Unification Church. Excuse me, Unification Church. Yes.
Absolutely. So both Syngman Rhee, the strong man of South.
Moon is the pivotable. Excuse me, pivotable. Excuse me, the pivot head, as it were, of the Unification Church. But ultimately, it is a function of the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, and that will play into the reality of what happened to President Kennedy, because ultimately we're going to see a very bizarre relationship between KCIA, the Unification Church, and the State Department of the United States, and just what exactly they were doing in that capacity. But that'll be in a future program.
Well, this is going to be a long series because now we're being told about, man, we've got to do this about the Chinese and blah, 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 blah. Barack Obama's pivot to Asia. What we are really doing in Asia, and I don't think this is unfair. So basically, since the end of World War II, we have been, and really, and I think those excerpts give an idea, we've been picking up the Japanese agenda in World War II, although I think if one were to analyze this structurally, both the Japanese and referencing the work from the Yamato Dynasty by the Seagraves, both the Japanese and then later the U.S. were executing Wall Street's agenda in Asia. Continuing,
Right.
we're hearing all about the Uyghurs and the alleged Chinese genocide, blah, 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 blah. The Uyghurs figure prominently in the Japanese force structure used in World War II, and we'll be developing that. The dividing of Korea at the 38th parallel. This one, as a member of the Vietnam generation, this absolutely blew my mind when you revealed this to me, Marty. The dividing of Korea at the 38th parallel by Colonels David Dean Rusk and Colonel Bonesteel, who later, I think, became a...
Both men are CIA operatives, I should know.
And later, Dean Rusk worked for Admiral Hillenkoetter when he was director of the CIA. And
correct.
He became...
It was Admiral Hillenkoetter's executive assistant.
Wonderful, wonderful. And Colonel Bonesteel later worked in Vietnam as a general for CIA. We're
right,
going to be
yeah.
Talking...
It should be noted that the theater commander in Vietnam, General Westmoreland, was in fact a what Colonel Prouty had established as a focal point officer, as was Colonel Bonesteel in Vietnam. But both those men were highly placed CIA focal point officers. And incidentally, the man that created the focal point officer staff was Colonel Prouty on the orders of Alan Dulles. You know, so it was essentially a CIA sheep-dipping operation for military intelligence.
Absolutely. We're going to be talking about what really happened with the Korean War. And a key Korean general had worked for the Japanese as a, quote, bandit hunter, General Kim Suk-won, and he was in charge of the border forces for Syngman Rhee in Korea. And we'll be talking about him. Very, very interesting. And later on, because what really happened in Korea, and we're going to be dipping into I.F. Stone's Hidden History of the Korean War, and substantive evidence that actually South Korea attacked the North in order to bait them into an invasion. And we're going to talk about what the Korean War did strategically for MacArthur and for Asia. Syngman Rhee was not popular in what was then South Korea, and there was a very real possibility of a democratic takeover. I mean, it's small
if,
the,
it, right, right. A small D democratic takeover. If I may, though, Dave, we're also going to be touching on something that's rather sensitive. However, I feel that it is both timely and important, especially with what the world went through with COVID. And certainly those members of the listening audience that are old enough to remember the AIDS crisis. We are also going to be touching on biological weapons programs and the deployment of certain biological weapons against the North Korean population during the Korean War, an operation that was overseen by the chief of intelligence in the Asian theater of operations during the Korean War, a man by the name of General Charles Andrew Willoughby.
And Willoughby is really important. We talked about him in connection with Frank, a really important guy. Yes, and for the record, 1171, 1172, and 1173, there was a wonderful book about Unit 731, the most advanced biological warfare program in the world at that time. It was run by the
right.
Japanese in Manchuria. But the British edition has a whole chapter that was left out of the American edition about the use of Unit 731 people in that biological warfare program. And Frank Olson, whose alleged suicide, he was actually murdered, is chronicled at great length in the wonderful book called A Terrible Mistake by Hank Alborelli, the late Hank Alborelli. That was one of the things that basically set him off. I mean, he just felt that America was doing things that were un-American, which he was quite right about. But continuing, we'll be talking about Willoughby. JFK cut loose Syngman Rhee and the White Terror, and I suspect that that had much, that was yet another factor leading to the coup d'etat on 11-22-63, the assassination of JFK, and that's exactly what that was. It was a military coup.
Well, ultimately, real quick, the roundabout, well, not roundabout, but the path that we're going to be taking, once again, in future programs, is the relationship between the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, the CAL organization, the Latin American Anti-Communist Confederation, and its relationship with DFS, which is Mexican Military Intelligence, the Federal Dirección Servistar, and ultimately its relationship with an organization called Los Tecos, or the Owls, based out of the Autonoma University of Guadalajara.
Which we spoke about at great length in connection with Max Egan von Hohenlohe, Winston Scott, and the first series of shows that we did. Continuing, and this is one that it just blows my mind. Someone, again, that grew up with the Beatles. We're going to be talking about, well, first of all, we're going to review JFK's attempts to extricate us from Vietnam. But Eisuke Ono, and the name spells, he was not only a very important Japanese banker, and the father, of course, of Yoko Ono, but he was a Japanese naval intelligence paymaster in the United States in 1933, and he was paying a Japanese spy of British nationality called Frederick Rutland. And he, Rutland, was employed by Mitsubishi in the early 20s and later, and he was training Japanese to fly off of, Japanese pilots to fly off of warships. Probably, in fact, I think it could be safely said, setting the stage for the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Yoko Ono's father, Eisuke Ono, also was very important in the post-World War II banking milieu in the intricate link with Golden Lily. And we're talking about his links to the Schroeder Bank, Mr. Tjarks, or Tarkas, T-I-A-R-K-S, Norbert Bogdan, and the Bank of Tokyo, with which Eisuke Ono was an official, was the successor to the Yokohama Specie Bank, 25% owned by the Emperor of Japan, and the most important bank for moving Japanese money around the world after World War II. So this will give people, again, this is kind of like an abstract for some of the topics we are going to be covering. It obviously will take a long time. One thing that I want to give you a heads up on, Monty, I fault myself in some of our last series of programs, in particular program 1342, we were like a couple of jazz musicians riffing, and that's great, but I forgot to, in a sense, have you provide our documentary sources and the spelling of key names. So at times I want to stress that I'm going to be asking for the documentation. I know you can document everything you're talking about, but it's important for the audience's comprehension to do that, and also to spell out any names. So we're going to be interrupting, but listen to 1342. It was like a couple of great jazz musicians just riffing off of each other.
I should know for the listening audience the reason why the bulk of the descriptions for the programs haven't been posted is simple enough. My computer broke and I just got it fixed.
Alrighty, well, you know, we're all dealing with technological burps, and we'll be doing
right.
This.
Real quick, one last portion of the program is, and this will probably be at the one of the last things that we do with Asia. Is I'd like very much to talk about a singular document, and the reason why it's singular in nature is because I see no other references anywhere within the CIA's cryptonym program that's posted to the National Archives website for it. So, but I'd like to dedicate one of these programs in the future, obviously not this one, but in the future, Dave, to a director's log for General Walter Beadle Smith from 1951. For those of you that don't know, General Walter Smith was the chief of G2 operations for the entire Supreme Allied Command in Europe, in the European theater of operations during the Second World War. And the late 40s, early 50s, I believe it was 1950 to 52, I think it was, he became the director of the CIA. And this particular document is heavily annotated. It's a director's log, and there are at least a dozen references to Chinese and North Korean Gladio operations. And once again, for those of you that don't know what Gladio is, that was a stay-behind army contingency. So this director's log is unique in the sense that it actually references Gladio operations being conducted against the North Koreans and the Chinese during the Korean War, and actually names off the cryptonym, which is their code name prefix, and the operatives that are involved in the stay behind ops. So I'd like to dedicate at least one program to Gladio stay behind operations in North Korea, because when you examine the officers that are involved in the Gladio operations in Korea, which I'm going to go ahead and just give the crypto name real quick because it's simple enough. The Gladio operations in Korea were called BG Mark. That's all capital letters. BGMARQUE.
And
BG Mark.
is that D as in dog or B as in boy?
I'll read that phonetically for everybody. That's Bravo Golf Mike Alpha Romeo Quebec Uniform Echo. BG Mark is the name of the Gladio stay behind operations into North Korea and China during the Korean War. And ultimately
Document, what document are you gleaming that from?
this is from the 1951, September to December 1951 director's log. So this is the personal day-to-day debriefing for General Walter Beadle Smith from September to December 1951, right before he relinquished command and gave over all operations to Alan Dulles. I should note that the chief of covert operations in 1951 for the CIA is Alan Dulles. So ultimately, he was the commander of the stay behind operations within the CIA. But as we shall see in a future program, the vast bulk of the stay behind commanders are later involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion, the Guatemalan coup d'etat, and I believe in the murder of President Kennedy. But we'll get to that in a later program.
We will, before we move to Sunrise, which I think might be a good place to begin this pivot to Asia, so to speak. Am I remembering correctly that the Uyghurs were among the forces used against the Japanese in North Korea, the Chinese and North Koreans?
Yes, that is correct. A what we call in the special forces world force multiplication. An emigre army was created specifically to fight the Chinese in the event that we invaded across the Yalu River and made our way into Manchuria and occupied Peking, which what is the modern day city for Peking? I
Beijing,
forget. Okay,
Beijing.
Beijing. Okay. So at the time, Peking, modern day Beijing, in the event that it was occupied by an invading force, meaning this emigre Uyghur army, yes, that is what they were being reserved for. And it's interesting how that overlaps with Colonel Prouty, because as I stated before, Colonel Prouty had a very interesting connection to the army of Indochina. And of course, Korea before the Korean War. Remember, we're talking about, the earlier excerpt that Mr. Emery shared with the audience. We should note that that was 1945, okay?
It was actually technically World War II was still underway, but the atomic bombs had been dropped, and it was obviously the war was about to end. And
In
the
fact, would it be possible to pivot to the information I wanted to share about that before we go into Sunrise? I
okay,
think you alluded to that we might be able to do that.
yeah, I think Sunrise might be a good place to begin the pivot to Asia in this discussion because it is already familiar to the audience. I did a program, I think, off the top of my head called, for the record, 576, called Darkness at Sunrise. It was basically, and Peter Dale Scott, in a the brilliant Berkeley researcher, in a magnificent essay in Covert Action, Information Bulletin number 25 from the winter of 1986, had an article called How Alan Dulles and the SS Preserve Each Other. And
Right.
Operation Sunrise really appears to have been fundamental to the fusion of the U.S. with both the axes. So I do want to get to Operation Sunrise because I think I don't want to overload the audience from a cognitive standpoint. But go ahead, talk about probably, but then we're going to get to Sunrise and something I did not realize until we began networking, that there was a Japanese link to Sunrise as well. Go ahead.
Absolutely. In fact, the Japanese link is also intrinsic with the Muslim Brotherhood links to the CIA through the personality of a man by the name of Francois Jeannot. So Jeannot and the Japanese intelligence agents at Sunrise all overlap with each other.
We'll get to that when we get to the discussion, but first Colonel Harvey, and then we're going to go to Sunrise.
Right, real quick, if I were to encapsulate Prouty and what exactly he was witnessing at the end of the Second World War, because he ultimately, and you'll have to forgive me, Dave, and ultimately your listening audience will have to forgive me on this, but I am of the opinion that certain whistleblowers aren't actually whistleblowers. They're actually involved in what we call in the intelligence community a limited hangout. And I am of the impression, this is just my own personal impression, I want to make that very clear, I'm not speaking for Mr. Emery or any element of his listening audience or any other researcher that has been on the For the Record program with Dave Emery. I should note that in my personal bearings, Colonel Prouty in his book, The Secret Team, was in fact a highly what we call a highly modified limited hangout. There are elements of fact in it, but then there's also elements of not pure untruth, but diversionary narratives that are flowing around in there.
Something
And
that
ultimately,
I would use to perhaps give some depth to listeners. When you have reached the position that Colonel Proudy had reached, he was the CIA focal point officer, particularly with regard to Air Force, but he was developing and helping to mobilize military units, air units in particular, that were going to be used in various CIA covert operations. And he did that for years. And he also developed what are called the focal point networks at Alan Dulles's request. And those are networks within other government agencies, military and civilian, that were in fact working for CIA. And I don't think that a knowledgeable listener should necessarily hear what you're saying and go, oh my God, David, mommy, they don't like Prouty. When you have reached Prouty's position,
Right.
and if you do come out and just basically lay it all on the line, then you wind up like Gary Underhill.
Precisely, precisely, a bullet in the head.
Exactly. So, one of the things about fascism is that once it kicks in, well, in the old saying that it can be truly said that treason doth never succeed, because when it doth succeed, none dare call it treason. And I think that also applies to up to a point to Colonel Proudy. And we are all indebted to Proudy for the
Yes, sir.
information he has made public. At the same time, if he had really let it all hang out, so to speak, he would have set a new world's indoor record for death.
Absolutely,
So,
absolutely, yeah.
with that, go ahead.
So, ultimately, I wanted to quote some information from a book called Blowback: America's Recruitment of Nazis and Its Destructive Impact on Our Domestic and Foreign Policy. This was written by Christopher Stimson, and I'm reading from pages 82 and reading again, reading from pages 182 and 184, and we can see that Colonel Prouty was involved in a program, as you pointed out, Dave. Colonel Prouty was front and center in the utilization of special forces emigre units, and ultimately the arming of special forces emigre units by using U.S. military weapons and, of course, transportation and other technical devices that they might need in the field, including radios and escape and evasion equipment, things of that sort. So, once again, this is from page 182 of the book Blowback by Christopher Stimson, and
Is this
I'm
the hardcover edition by Weidenfeld and Nicholson?
No, I'm actually reading from the Forbidden Bookshelf Kindle electronic edition.
Okay, very good. Go ahead.
So this is the updated version. That incidentally, Hank Apparelli, the author that you mentioned earlier, he actually provided an updated introduction to the Kindle edition. So it's a fascinating entry. But the quote: And this is Prouty speaking. And that's another thing I'd like to note before I begin here. This is Prouty. These are Prouty's words, okay? I mean, this is the information that he gave to authorize Christopher Stimson, excuse me, to publish for his book Blowback. So what I'm reading is Prouty speaking, okay? So continuing, page 182 in the book Blowback by Stimson.
The name is Simpson, S-I-M-P-S-O-N.
Oh, Simpson. Yeah, you're correct. Simpson, thank you.
Go ahead.
Quote, the process of integrating ex-Nazi emigre groups into the United States nuclear operations may be traced to at least early 1947, when General Hoyt Vandenberg became the first chief of staff of the newly independent United States Air Force. As an editorial aside, it should be noted that there was no Air Force before July 7th, 1947. Before that, it was called the United States Army Air Forces, and it was a contingent of the United States Army. Okay? So, continuing. Vandenberg had commanded the 9th Air Force in Europe during World War II and had been tapped to head the Central Intelligence Group, the immediate predecessor of the CIA, in 1946. Among the general's responsibilities at Air Force was the development of written plans describing strategies and tactics for the use of America's new nuclear weapons in the event of a war. This is Prouty speaking, quote, Vandenberg had a clear idea about just how he thought a nuclear war was going to be fought, argues retired Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who is a senior aide to the Air Force Chief of Staff in the 1940s and later a top liaison man between the Pentagon and CIA. He, meaning Vandenberg, once again, this is Prouty speaking, he knew that if there was to be a nuclear exchange in those days, and we were talking about atomic bombs now, not H-bombs, you would destroy the communications and lifeblood of a country, but the country would still exist. It would just be rubble. People would be wandering around wanting to know who the boss was and where the food was coming from and so forth, but the country would still be there. Therefore, U.S. thinking went, we must begin to create independent communication centers inside the Soviet Union after the blast and begin to pull it together for our ends in the event of a nuclear war. The Army, Air Force, and CIA began competing programs to prepare for a post-nuclear battlefield. This included the creation of what eventually became called Special Forces, better known today as the Green Berets in the United States Army and the Air Resupply Communications Wings of the Air Force. Incidentally, the Air Force Air Special Operations contingencies were known as the Blue Berets.
By the way, the Nazi origins of the Green Beret and in the immediate post-World War II period is discussed at length in AFA program number 2. Go ahead, Monty. And remember, we're talking about, I want you to eventually tie this in with Asia. Go ahead.
Right, absolutely. The job, continuing with Prouty, this is once again Prouty speaking. The job of these units, Prouty explains, was to set up anti-communist political leaders backed up by guerrilla armies inside of the USSR and Eastern Europe in the wake of an atomic war, capture political power in strategic sections of the country, choke off any remaining communist resistance, and ensure that the Red Army could not regroup for a counterattack. And this is Prouty speaking. Quote, somebody had to bring back order into the country, and before the communists can do it, we were going to do it, come flying in there and do it and get the job done, Prouty says. Once again, this is Prouty speaking. Quote, the Eastern European and Russian emigre groups that we picked up from the Germans were the center of this. They were the personnel, according to the retired colonel. The CIA, once again, I would stress for the sixth time, this is Prouty speaking, not my words, not Christopher Simpson. Quote, the CIA was to prepare these forces in peacetime, stockpile weapons, radios, and jeeps for them to use, and keep them ready in the event of a war. A lot of this equipment came from military surplus from World War II. The CIA was also supposed to have some contacts inside the USSR worked out ahead of time for use when we got there. And that was also the job of the emigre groups on the agency payroll. In the meantime, the emigre troops were useful for espionage or covert action. Both the Army and the CIA laid claim to the authority to control guerrilla foot soldiers after a thermonuclear exchange had actually been declared. End quote.
So now again, how does this relate? Because we need to pivot to Asia. I mean, that is a development of what we've spoken about in AFAQ.
Ultimately, everything that Colonel Prouty described is exactly what was set up in Asia under General Arisu, General Kodama, and General Willoughby. The entire structure that we're talking about was set up by the nuclear war planning contingency of General Vandenberg within the when he was acting as chief of staff as the Air Force, and of course, General Vandenberg's top aide, his chief of staff, was Colonel Prouty. And ultimately, we have to appreciate that I have just demonstrated that there was a Gladio stay behind army apparatus set up within Japanese intelligence at the end of World War II, where all of G2 command for the Japanese is repurposed for this particular purpose. And at no other point, I would argue, in American military history, do we get closer to dropping thermonuclear weapons on an enemy than Korea. And ultimately, the emigre task force that was set up by Colonel Prouty and the special operations teams under General Willoughby was the Uyghur Army. Okay? And we'll get back to that when we talk about the Uyghurs. But everything I have just described to your audience, or ultimately what Colonel Prouty described to the audience, Dave, is exactly what Arisu and General Kodama had set up for the CIA. This was an emigre Gladio stay behind army that was hemispheric in its scope and ultimately was the eyes and ears of the CIA and US military intelligence in the event of a thermonuclear war. And we came so close to having an exchange during the Korean War. More so than I would argue than the Cuban Missile Crisis. We the field and the difference between the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Korean War is simple. Field commanders during the Korean War had the authorization to drop nukes, meaning that MacArthur could have preemptively dropped a thermonuclear bomb without the final authorization from President Truman. This did not exist in 1962, mainly because President Kennedy had pooled those war powers out of the hands of the CIA and the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But we'll get to that at a later time.
Very quickly, I want to interject. We're hearing all about the Uyghurs today and the alleged genocide. Many Muslim countries have visited China, and none of them have endorsed the propaganda, frankly, that is being disseminated in this country. But one of the interesting things is that the point person, and I've spoken about him at great length, for the alleged genocide against the Uyghurs, blah, 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 the forced labor camps, blah, 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 and also for what's going on in Tibet, and we've spoken about Tibet at great length, is a guy named Adrian Zenz. He is a German fascist, and he might not like the term fascist, but I think there are those who would, that he is a member of the Victims of Communist Memorial Foundation, which is a
That's right.
direct offshoot of the Captive Nations Committee. And that was co-founded by Lev Dobryansky, part of the OUNB milieu, and Yaroslav Stetsko, who was the wartime head of the Ukrainian collaborationist state that fought with the Nazis, and also was front and center for much of the Holocaust, specifically the Holocaust of bullets. So there is a direct link there. Now, in the pivot to Asia, let's go back to Operation Sunrise. And Monty, if I could ask you very quickly, because we've got about 15 minutes left, a little less. Summarize what Operation Sunrise is, and then inform the audience from documentary sources, what is the Japanese link to Sunrise?
Essentially, Operation Sunrise was a highly illegal, I would argue, treasonous surrender deal between the chief of SS forces in occupied northern Italy, which was called the Salo government. That was an SS general by the name of Karl Wolff, And the OSS chief of station in Bern, Switzerland during the Second World War, Alan Welsh Dulles, the future director of the CIA. So it was a treasonous secret surrender between one of the prime architects of the Holocaust. In fact, Karl Wolff was deputy to Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, and the chief of OSS station in Bern, Switzerland, Alan Dulles.
And by the way, Lyman Lemitzer, who was eventually relieved of his position as chairman of the Joint Chiefs by JFK, later served on the Rockefeller Commission. He was a character witness for General Karl Wolff at his Nuremberg trial. So that is fascinating that the quote, secret surrender, as Alan Dulles called it, was completely treasonous. Galen was aware of it, as the Peter Dale Scott, but I've read that into the record and for the record programs. 11:47, 8:9, and 50. And by the way, that article by Peter Dale Scott, again, in Covert Action Quarterly, or Covert Action Information Bulletin, as it was called then, number 25, in the winter of 86, was supposed to have been turned into a book. But the, what we'll call it, the professional headwinds, unquote, became too stiff, and Peter Dale Scott backed off of that. And it's those same, and what a euphemism, professional headwinds, that I think, Colonel Prouty's, activities should be seen in. But the Sunrise negotiations, like the negotiations we spoke about in earlier programs with Prince Max Aken von Hohenlohe as a cat's paw for Walter Schellenberg, working with Alan Dulles and later William Donovan, these are completely treasonous. They were done behind Roosevelt's back, and I think in many ways could be seen as the stage upon which the eventual JFK assassination coup d'etat were performed. So, Sunrise and the Japanese connection the same.
Correct.
Go ahead.
Well, I stumbled across a peculiar name in one of the books that I had read on at least two or three other occasions called A Dreamer of the Day by the late Kevin Coogan. The subtext on that is the subtitle on that is Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International. And I believe Dreamer of the Day was put up by the paperback was put up by Auto Media, and was I'm sorry,
Apollo
Autonomia
Media,
Media, correct? Yeah.
and I've interviewed Kevin, the late brilliant Kevin Coogan, many times about Dreamer of the Day. So it's a name in terms of the author and the book, and Francis Parker Yockey are well known to this audience. Proceed, Monty.
So I'll go ahead and just quote from the pertinent information, and where exactly I first saw this peculiar name. So this is from Appendix E of the Dreamer of the Day, and the Appendix E is titled "Échec François, Friend to Hitler and Carlos the Jackal." Quote: On 30 May 1996, an obscure Swiss banker named François Jeannot committed suicide in Geneva, Switzerland. From the brief mention of his death in the New York Times, one would not know that one of the most important figures in the history of 20th century terrorism had died. And how many men can say that they were friends with both Adolf Hitler and Carlos the Jackal? A Swiss citizen born in Lausanne in 1915, Jeannot became rabidly pro-Nazi in the early 1930s. After a trip to Germany as a teenager, he never forgot the thrill he felt shaking Adolf Hitler's hand. During World War II, Jeannot became extremely close to a Sicherheitsdienst lieutenant by the name of Paul Dickoff, last name spelled Dickoff, who would later become the head of the German Federal Police.
And also ran Interpol for a period of time.
Correct.
He's
Yeah.
covered in AFA number one, by the way.
Right. The BKA, before being elected president of Interpol in 1968. The two men traveled across occupied Europe. Dickoff would later claim that he had defected from the German army in August of 1942 and lived clandestinely in Belgium, where he embraced the anti-Nazi cause. Curiously, the traitor's salary continued to be sent to his wife until January 1944, meaning he was a SD agent that entire time. Dickoff eventually ended up in Switzerland, where he had received support from Jeannot. Dickoff went there to approach Alan Dulles, the head of the local OSS, pretending to be an anti-Nazi. At the time, his boss in the Reich's main security command, Riesche, Ernst Kaltenbrunner, was also sanctioning the Free Austria movement, yet another group of anti-Nazi Nazis intent on befriending Dulles. As an editorial aside here, I should note that the commander of the Free Austria movement and their ultimate paymaster is Max Egan von Hollenoy, another man who's involved in these secret surrender deals. Continuing. Ernst Kaltenbrunner was also sanctioning the Free Austria movement, yet another group of anti-Nazi Nazis intent on befriending Dulles. Dickoff quickly established a working relationship with one of the most mysterious American spies of the Second World War, the Japanese-born, Yale-educated Paul Blum. That last name on the spelling on his last name is B-L-U-M, Blum. Reading again. Dickoff quickly established a working relationship with one of the most mysterious American spies of the World War II, the Japanese-born and Yale-educated Paul Blum, a top Dulles lieutenant who would later vouch for Dickoff's anti-Nazi credentials. Jeannot, too, was in the thick of things, having established a friendship with SS General Karl Wolff, leader of the German team in Italy, that negotiated Operation Sunrise with Dulles. Shortly after the war, real quick, I'd like to note that Karl Wolff, for those listeners that don't know, as an editorial, Karl Wolff oversaw the deportation of 2 million men, women, and children out of Italy during the Second World War, the vast bulk of them Jews who ended up inside of the concentration camp systems of Nazi Germany. So, Karl Wolff potentially had the blood of hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children on his hands. He was a mass murdering.
Absolutely. He was a war criminal of the first order, and Lyman Lendnitzer, later chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and a member of the Rockefeller Commission, was a character witness for Wolf at his Nuremberg trials. Go ahead, Moppy.
Right. reading again. Karl Wolff, leader of the German team in Italy that negotiated Operation Sunrise at Dulles. Shortly after the war, Jeannot acquired publishing rights to the works of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels. He also played another major, if murky, role in aiding fugitive Japanese war criminals. Another key player in the post-war Nazi underground resident in Switzerland was Sinkdirektdienst Colonel Eugene Dolman, last name spelled D-O-L-L-M-A-N-N, General Wolff's chief lieutenant in the talks of Dulles. Besides Wolff, Dolman and Jeannot had another friend in common, Haj Admin el-Hussein, the Grand Mutif of Jerusalem. Jeannot first met the Grand Mutif in Jerusalem in 1936 and again in Berlin during the war.
It's actually the Grand Mufti, it's Haj Admin al-Husseini. He is a very important, but largely unrecognized person. He not only had the rank of a general in the Waffen-SS, but included three Balkan Muslim Waffen-SS divisions, three Muslim Waffen-SS divisions in the Balkans alone. He also later became the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, and with the fascist element and the Zionist movement having eventually become ascendant in Israel, and that's why we have the bloodbath that we're seeing there now. A very important person, largely unrecognized. Continue. Grand Mufti Haj Amin al-Husseini.
Okay. After the 23 July 1952 Free Officers coup, Jeannot established ties with Egyptian intelligence operative by the name of Major Fatih al-Dedeb. In the post-coup Egypt, he experienced...
How's his name spelled, please?
Full spelling on his name is F-A-T-H-I, lowercase A-L, dash, capital D-I-B.
Okay.
In the post-coup Egypt, he experienced firsthand the strange mixture of left and right when half of Cairo's most influential weekly newspaper, Roz Alafes, was filled with references to figures like Soviet writer Alaya Ehrenberg, and the other half carried reprints of anti-Semitic hate sheets like the American journal Common Sense. In 1955, the Grand Mutif's friend Johann von Leers, helping to run Egypt's propaganda ministry and its all-important Institute for the Study of Zionism, Jeannot began to see Egypt as a base for anti-French FLN independence movement in Algeria. He worked in Tangier with with an ex-SS officer by the name of Heinz Reichenberg to create the Arabo Africa Import Export Company, which supplied the FLN with weapons. Arabo Africa, spelling on that is Arabo-Africa.
And how was Reichenberg's name spelled? We got just 4 minutes. We got about 4 minutes left.
Reichenberg, Reichenberg.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Arabo Africa was actually a cover enterprise established by Werner Naumann's network, which included Jeannot's friend Dr. Heimar Horace Greeley Schultz, in Damascus, General Otto Ramir, Ernst William Springer, and an ex-SS captain and Risha operative by the name of Alsos Brunner created another gun-running operation, this one titled the Orient Trading Company, to ship arms to the FLN.
A couple of those names. Alois Brunner, of course, one of the top Nazi officials involved with the Holocaust, later became a key BND operative in Syria. And also, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, S-C-H-A-C-H-T, the finance minister of Nazi Germany. One of his blood relatives, Robert, was the admissions officer for Albert Einstein University, or college, I should say, that Lee Harvey Oswald was supposedly matriculating to when he, quote, defected, unquote, to the Soviet Union. We got just over 3 minutes left, Amagi, so maybe find a good stopping place, and we'll wrap this up and continue on our next interview.
Ultimately, I want to end all references to Kevin Coogan's book and the appendix that I was reading from with this editorial note. Everything that I just described with the North African Arabists, the fascists that are operating with Heimar Schultz and Alfons Brunner and the teams under Otto Ramir and Francois Jeannot, the arming of the FLN, and ultimately later on the OAS, fascinatingly enough. and these fascist intelligence networks that are ultimately being run all throughout North Africa. The facilitating officer for all of that, as I shall demonstrate soon, is Paul Blum, who during the Second World War was one of Alan Dulles's deputies in the OSS in Switzerland, and ultimately the commander of all X2. Now, X2 is counter-espionage, counterintelligence for the OSS nomenclature in Switzerland during the Second World War. And in the next program, we'll see just who Paul Blum was working with in conjunction with Carl Wolf in establishing these Nazi rat lines and ultimately the post-World War II fascist presence in North Africa and what they have to do with Japanese banking.
Okay, we'll get to that in just a minute. A few of the names very quickly. Johann von Leers, later Omar Amin von Leers, Otto Ernst Rehmer, R-E-M-E-R, as well as Alois Brunner, Hajimin al-Husseini, Eugen Dolman. These are all names that people can search in the SpitfireList.com website. We have abundant documentation on them. And they also, by the way, people like Johann von Leers, Hajimin al-Husseini, they also track back to the milieu that evolved into the bank Al-Taqwa, that had an unlimited line of credit for Al-Qaeda, but I've spoken about that at great length in the past. So we will be continuing with this, and if this seems far afield, we are in the process of pivoting to Asia. And
yeah, ultimately what the listening audience just heard was the pivot. The information I shared about Prouty and the Bloodstone operations, you know, the nuclear contingency stay behind ops, and what Paul Blum did with Carl Wolf in North Africa, that is the pivot. And that background has to be understood before we make this pivot.
Very good. We are all out of time, however. This concludes For the Record program number 1345. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 19. This is being recorded on September 1st of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for